je mee naar boven, ga je mee naar bed. Onder de grijze dweilen roken we sigaret. En je geklets daar heel tevreden, de hele reis wiet met je mee. Als je even om me keert, als je even om me keert.
Well, what a treasure getting that song. Could you tell us more about the song and the voices behind it?
Sure. Well, actually, the lyrics, what they mean, they translate as, come along upstairs, come along to bed. Under the gray rags, we'll smoke a cigarette and we'll chat to our heart's content. The entire row swings back and forth if you dare to turn around. If you dare to turn around. What this is about is they used to have the appels, where you'd have to stand in line for hours in the cold weather waiting for your number to be called. And they would do it in the morning. They would do it again at night. And if you were far back online and your number had already been called, you might be able to just sneak off the line and go back to your bunk and have a little bit of time to talk to your friends. So that's what this lyric is about, the times when their numbers had been called, and perhaps like Hetty and Gisela, they were basically could sneak away and go to bed and get under their rags, and maybe there'd be a ersatz cigarette they'd be able to smoke and they'd be able to talk. Meanwhile, the entire row was still going through this long name calling procedure.
You have some other excerpts from the interviews with Hetty and Gisela. Maybe you can introduce them.
Sure. Well, Hetty was remarkable in the sense of, she said so herself, she was a major daredevil. It's amazing she was still alive. She actually passed away a couple of years ago. But the fact that she wasn't killed back then is remarkable because she actually stood up to the Nazis. I think it might have been that she was a very attractive 21-year-old, spunky, saucy, young Dutch woman. And for some reason, they just decided to not kill her. Here's an example in this excerpt of how she would respond to the Nazis. She had been hiding children before she was arrested, as I said, and several of those children had been named Gottschalk. And in this excerpt, we hear about a time when she was interrogated by a Nazi officer named Gottschalk. She talks about how she kind of liked these encounters with the Nazis.
Provocation, challenge. I love challenges.
You love challenges.
Yes, that is it. Yeah. That makes me feel fine. Especially against your friend, you won't be beaten by him. Whatever he does, you'll always be the master of it. That was the way I was thinking about it.
This was your way of preserving your identity.
Yes, I think so.
Rather than
And I think my friend Gisela, this is Piglet, she exactly understood when I had it a little bit more than she. She always said she was nice and blonde and she was looking like a German. Her name was German. She had Gisela Zöhnlein, her grandparents, came from Dutch or from German origin.
Yeah.
She was treated much nicer.
Uh-huh.
From the beginning, I was treated, they first said, you have false papers, you are a Jew, you are Jewish.
Uh-huh.
And the man who was interrogating me in a very harsh way, he was named Gottschalk. So I told him, Herr Gottschalk, ich habe genauso viel jüdisches Blut wie Sie.
Translate?
Mr. Gottschalk, I have exactly as much Jewish blood as you have.
Uh-huh.
And instead of beating me, he didn't say anything. So I'm sure he had Jewish blood. From that moment, I got things to wash myself and all these things. But then I felt how it was to be treated like a Jew. You were humiliated so terribly. They thought, I won't get myself being humiliated. And I had two boys with the name of Gottschalk. I've hidden them, so I thought, it's not... Yeah. You're Jewish also.
Yeah.
Another quality that I saw in Gisela and Hetty that really just blew me away was their capacity for positive thinking. They told me that all during their imprisonment, they always had faith that they would someday return to their families, return to a free Holland. And in this next excerpt, we hear Gisela talking a little bit about that.
But then the Allies came.
Yes.
And the Germans took everybody from Vurtungharesbrück, Otto Sachsenhausen, the land.
Yeah.
And that was really bad camp.
That was a bad camp.
Yeah, as I told you, because of so many people who were there and dirty and not enough food and so on. But still, we tried to. We always thought the Germans will lose the war.
You always thought?
Always. It will not take a long time. We thought 7 weeks. Well, it was, I think, 8 months. So you had always the idea, they cannot win the war, at the end of everything will be all right.
That strong conviction.
Yeah.
So can't you imagine, like, she's there in the concentration camp, and her hair has been shaved, she's in these striped clothes full of lice, she's hungry, cold, and there she is, believing that the Allies will win the war, everything is going to be okay. That's just, really, when you think about it, that's just incredible positive thinking.
It is. It's incredible positive thinking. There are 8 other voices in this book that you chose to include. I'm wondering if we can hear some more of them.
Sure. Well, one rescuer I became very fond of is named Case Veenstra. Case ran a bookstore for many, many years after the war, and he was particularly good at English. And he would sometimes suddenly pull a quote out of the air by Emily Dickinson or so forth. Very articulate man. And during the war, very, very brave, as were all the others. Case tried to find people who would be willing to take in Jewish children. And he wasn't always successful. Sometimes the rescuers had a bit of like rose-colored glasses, thinking that other people would respond the same way that they were responding. But they sometimes found out that other people were responding very differently. And we have an excerpt in which Case talks about one attempt he made to try and find safe hiding places for Jewish children.
Let's listen.
I once helped a Dutch girl who got in problems. She got accosted by a few laborers, and I took her part, helped her, freed her. And it appeared her father was head of a big Protestant church publishing firm. And that father, Mr. Van Eyck, he wrote me a long letter, to thank me. He said, well, if I can do anything for you, just let me know. So I thought, well, he's got a big publishing firm and printer's firm as well in Nijkerk, and he has about 80 laborers. Perhaps he can say to me, this man is reliable, you try him, or he can recommend people.
To recommend people who would take in
who would take, yes. So I wrote him a letter that I would like to visit him, and then that was about 40 kilometers away, and he wrote me, I was welcome, and he invited me to dinner in a time when we had very little food, but he, as a director of the big printing firm, he had everything, so I went there and had a meal, and at the end of the meal he folded his hands and said, good Lord, and he had a quite a lot of words, and then he said, "And specially I ask your attention for all those people that are pestered by the Germans." And so I thought, well, I'm sitting on roses, as we say in Holland. Oh, that's good. And so after the meal, he took me apart and said, "What can I do for you?" Well, I said, "As it is, look here, we are looking for people who will take Jewish children, boys." And then he said, "How can you ask me that? I'm the director of a firm with a lot of responsibility. How dare you ask me?" So that was quite different from what I expected. And so I thought, well, with full attention to it, and Lord, please. And that's theory and practice.
Well, one family that did put theory into practice were the Koorstras. Helchi Koorstra was one of the very religious rescuers. And she decided that, she and her husband decided to take in a Jewish man because they were trying to find safe places for Jews to hide. But whenever they would approach a farmer or someone who they thought would be a good prospect, they would always be asked, "Well, have you taken in any children?" And they would say, "Well, no, we have three young daughters and small house." But these farmers wouldn't accept any excuses. They would always back out once they heard that the Koorstras hadn't taken in any children. So they took in this Jewish man just to say they had taken in someone. And when they heard his stories, the kind of suffering that he had gone through, innocent person being subjected to terrible things, they said, "Well, we have to do more." And then they heard about a Jewish family that was wandering around in the woods, and they took them in. They showed up with straw in their hair. They'd slept in a haystack. And then they had three more people in their house. And then they wound up taking in another family of three. So they kept on with this. Within less than a year, they had nine extra people in their house with their three daughters and she and her husband. It was pretty amazing. I interviewed her in their little house, and I was just amazed that not only did they do this great thing, but that all of these people survived the war. Unlike the tragic story of Anne Frank, where someone betrayed them and everybody got picked up, all of these people made it through and they remained lifelong friends. I think that a lot of the motivation, or rather the thing about their personalities, was that they had all had some kind of model growing up that modeled this kind of altruistic behavior, that taught them empathy, that taught them to care not only about their own group, but also about other groups, people in other groups, even strangers. And one very interesting thing is that when I had a chance to speak with Miep Gies, who helped to hide the Anne Frank family, she said that one factor was that when she was a young girl in Austria, following World War I, she was malnourished, and there was a humanitarian program that would send Austrian girls to Holland to be fed and sheltered and basically just to be loved until they got back to normal. And Miep participated in this program, and she went to Holland, and she was picked up by a family in Holland and taken care of. And she felt that was a factor as to why she would help the Jewish people, the Franks, when they needed help. Well, what I found that was really fascinating was that quite a few of the people I interviewed remembered that same humanitarian program and said that their own parents had participated in that same program. And I have an excerpt from my interview with Heti Vauta in which that came out.
There was a program where families in the Netherlands had volunteered to take children from Austria.
We had them. We had them from Germany and from Austria, children, after the war.
You, your family?
Yes.
Okay, tell me
about
that.
For years afterwards, they became, of course, those girls became our friends. And I was still very small. But my mother always told me they came there a train with staffed girls, little girls and boys. And they were in a big room. And then mother could choose who she wanted to take home with her. And there was a small black-haired girl, and my mother asked, do you like playing with dolls? No. Do you like embroidery? No. Then no. Oh, then my mother said, you're exactly like my children. Come with me.
That's great.
And that became a big friend, and afterwards her family also came, and we had other girls, yes, we often had children.
And how long
out of those groups?
They stayed for months?
For months, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. But we were seven, so it was very easy that there came some more. That made no difference.
Hetty's account suggests that these individuals were profoundly influenced by a legacy, a precedent of humanitarianism. What happened after World War II? That tradition that they were part of, that some of them viewed themselves as part of, continue into the post-World War II period? You suggested it did early in the introduction.
Oh, absolutely. They've remained the people that they are. The Nazi occupation of Holland was a particularly dramatic opportunity to be of service, but they've remained of service throughout all the years since the war. Hetty started a ecological foundation with her children. Gisela somewhat just settled down to a kind of a normal life, so to speak. But she talked about giving to charity, UNICEF. Her daughter became a social worker. Some of the others, Meek Vermeer, became involved with Amnesty International, have something called the Freedom Writers Program, where you write letters on behalf of people who have been unjustly imprisoned. Meek passed away a few years ago. I'm sure if she were alive today, she would be just appalled by what the U.S. government has been doing, holding people without recourse to a trial on very flimsy evidence, casting this very, very wide net of suspected terrorists and just arresting people. And I'm sure she would be writing letters about that and about Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. By the way, the rescuers, all but one of the rescuers that I've been keeping in touch with, are opposed to the war in Iraq. They're very upset about it, partially because they loved the United States. The United States was the country that liberated them from Hitler's rule and from starvation. At the end of the war, there was terrible starvation, and the U.S. did these wonderful food drops. And they're just very upset that the trusted country that liberated them during World War II has now become a perpetrator of unnecessary violence. Just in fairness, I should add, one of them said, well, if it had all gone the way George Bush planned, it would have been okay, but it's gone very, very differently, and I'm not pleased about it. So they've continued to be active. They've looked back at the war as being a special time, because, you know, it's fine to write letters and to participate in petitions, protests, giving money to good causes, but they recognize that during the war, where so many, many people were bystanders. They put their lives on the line to do what they felt was right. And they've never had that kind of drama again. And I think we should listen to this excerpt from Kees Veenstra, because he very poignantly expresses that feeling.
Often I think the war was the best part of my life. That's of course ridiculous. Horrible things happened. But you could be useful then. You could save people. You could do things. And you were glad, and people were glad with anything they got food, etc. And now we are well fed and not content. That's, everybody, even my children, take anything for granted. And I know it's not that way, you know, it can be quite different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's silly to say the war was a great time, but I've wept also in that time, but still. Yeah, something happened. Don't misunderstand me. I would advise to have a war again. But still, it was quite clear what was good, it was quite clear what was bad. Yeah. You had to do the good things.
Well, Mark, what a wonderful way to end this discussion on that note.
I hope that this program today will activate people's activism, even as my own activism was activated by meeting the rescuers face to face.
I hope so too. Mark, thank you so much for being on Talking History. We've been talking to Mark Klempner, the author of The Heart Has Reasons, Holocaust Rescuers and Their Stories of Courage. And the book has just come out, right?
Book's just come out. And those who want more information can find it on a website that has the same name as the title of the book. It's www.hearthasreasons.com.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Jerry.